I think what makes this a fascinating scenario is the fact that it occurred at night in visual conditions on a practice instrument approach. It just appears to be such a laid-back scenario. And while I agree with your choice, number three is the best of the choices, I think what we have to recognize here is that this guy was real close to dying. I mean, he was very close to the ground in a state of spatial disorientation where it would have been very, very easy for him to flip that airplane upside down at low altitude. And then what do we have? I mean, this very, very simple scenario, I think I'll go out, get a little instrument training at night, was real close to a real scary event.
It just shows how easy it is for a pilot who is fat, dumb, and happy, everything going well in a good weather situation, for him to almost lose total control of the airplane and put that airplane into the ground with just a simple distraction.
So let's look at how this guy got here, okay? I mean, he was very well intentioned. He started down the road and everything was going pretty good right up until the point where what he wanted was a practice approach to Pompano, and he ends up on a visual approach.
Very simply, he allowed ATC to push him into that. He should have stated that he wanted a standard instrument approach to a specific runway at that airport, considering the conditions that night.
And that brings up an interesting approach, because as instructors and as just pilots, there's a difference between a practice approach and a real approach. And if we want a practice approach, we have to recognize that we may or may not fit in with the flow of traffic. So it may cost us something. There may be a delaying vector to get what we want. But ATC is trying to get airplanes on the ground. We want to get a practice approach. So we have a minor disconnect there. So here's a situation where the guy didn't really want a visual approach, wasn't actually prepared for a visual approach. And this thing kind of accelerated on him. And he's lost at night, disoriented. And the thing really went to heck in a handbasket, like right now.
And I think if he'd had more experience, he would have probably recognized early on that coming into a Florida airport with really good weather, the norm is going to be a visual approach. Knowing he wanted to get a practice approach, in my view, one of his early mistakes was not telling that to ATC as soon as he checked in with approach control. That would have put him probably on that ILS to 1-5 and eliminated this whole incident.
Let's take a look at what the heck is a visual approach. Now, if you asked pilot A, B, and C to define a visual approach, well, I think the answers would kind of be all over the place. So, John, would you tell us what the basic parameters are for a visual approach, just so we understand what we're getting into, this realm, and then we'll kind of zero in on some of the pitfalls that may occur.
Sure. A visual approach is a approach procedure where you navigate from your present position to the airport strictly by visual means, either following another aircraft or by navigating on your own. ATC uses it routinely to expedite traffic. It can be a time saver. It can be a fuel saver. But it doesn't come without some limitations. Among the basic requirements are the airport has to be at least basic VFR 1003. Before ATC can initiate a vector for a visual approach, there's certain criteria that has to be met also, certain weather criteria. It has to be at least 500 feet above the minimum vectoring altitude, because you don't want to get people sucked into a situation where you're vectoring them to an airport that they can't see. But ATC has the responsibility for providing separation up to the point that the approach clearance is issued. And then there's really two conditions. There's one is the approach clearance. When you're following another aircraft and you sight the aircraft, you're pretty much on your own then. You maintain your own wake turbulence separation. You maintain your own terrain separation. If you don't see the aircraft you're following, then ATC will assume at least that part of the role.
So our scenario pilot here didn't have the runway.
Nope.
But he did have the other aircraft, at least for a while.
Briefly.
Okay. And then all of a sudden, he didn't have the airport and he didn't have the other airplane. And he's fiddling with his GPS. And he's descending, and all of a sudden, we have a lost pilot on our hands.
ATC will issue that clearance based upon what you tell them at the time, and they will monitor it. But we're expected to be proficient pilots when we go into the system. And if you accept a clearance that you're not prepared for, ATC doesn't know that. They're going to assume that you're going to be able to follow whatever the clearance is and fulfill the requirements of that. And in this case, that was the big issue, is he wasn't in a position to execute the clearance that he was issued.
John, I have to confess, until we started discussing this scenario, I was not aware that telling ATC you had the traffic insight would get you cleared for a visual approach, even though you had not admitted that you had the airport insight. So I've learned that, and that was another mistake on this pilot's part. As he got into this, he accepted the visual approach. He had the opportunity to say unable,
Right.
To ATC at that time. I still want vectors because I don't have the airport in sight, correct?
And that does go back to one of our earlier statements. I do take a little offense that ATC pushed him into this, okay? The ATIS said that there's a visual approach is in progress. Initial contact, they said expect a vector for the visual approach. They have multiple opportunities to speak up. ATC is going to issue whatever the approach clearance is, and it's the norm there. So it becomes incumbent upon the pilot to speak up in that case.
Perhaps you're right, John. The pilot involved was not assertive enough in presenting their position.
And it's very simple.
Any pilot should be very cautious in accepting a visual approach based on following the preceding aircraft, particularly at night or if there are scattered clouds around. I can remember a case where I accepted a visual approach many years ago following an aircraft, and that aircraft descended through a scatter layer, and I lost sight of it, and I didn't know where I was at that point because
right.
I had assumed I'd just follow this aircraft to the runway. This is before the days of GPS. And you have to scramble at that point.
And that's a good point, too, because in this situation that you just described, you don't even know that the other airplane is on a visual approach. That airplane may have been on an ILS where he could descend through a cloud, and you saw him. Does that mean you can descend through the cloud and follow him?
Good point. And another dramatic difference between a visual approach and our standard instrument approach procedures is the absence of a missed approach procedure. And as we've said over and over again with this group, how important the missed approach is on any instrument approach. But when you accept a visual, what's your missed approach procedure?
There is none.
There is none.
Okay. So what do you do when you encounter weather, when you lose the airplane in front of you, when you lose visual contact with the airport? What's your procedure?
Another mistake this pilot made, when he lost sight of that airplane, he should have immediately advised ATC that he's lost sight of the airplane.
Right.
Instead, he tried to recover on his own by fixing his GPS, which then further caused a problem for him. Had he advised ATC, I'm sure they would have just given him a vector and taken him right to the airport.
And how often do we do that? Who's the first one to fess up that you're lost? You're an instrument pilot in a good VFR weather. You're going to fess up that you're lost? No, you're going to probably try and figure it out on your own and push ahead.
But one of the complexities of this situation, which we haven't talked about yet, is finding an airport in a metropolitan area at night. Anybody ever have trouble doing that?
Yeah. All the time.
Thousands and thousands of pilots on a regular basis. Trying to find an airport in a metropolitan area is tough. So we have to recognize that it is an issue. As we said, fess up. If you tell tower, if you tell air traffic, I've lost sight of the airport, what are they going to do? They're going to come back. Airport is clock position and distance. And all of a sudden, you've gone from lost to at least you're looking in the right direction, as opposed to being lost.
Further confusion occurred when he apparently sighted Fort Lauderdale Exec Airport, which has a similar runway configuration, and was further confused by the fact that his CDI was indicating that a localizer was off to the left, but he thought he was lined up with the southeast runway, and actually he was looking at a different airport.
Yeah.
And he was about ready to join the club of I've landed at the wrong airport,
yes.
Wasn't he? There's
yes.
a lot of other pilots yes. in that club.
Yes.
Yes.
Doesn't that start back on the ground before we plan our flight? Mm-hmm. Do we expand our review of our approach? Hey, what other airports are around here? A, because they are resources, other places we can land in case of an emergency, but also a place we can land if we do an oopsie. And let's also remember, because all of us have been there and few of us admit it, the mental capacity it takes when you get lost. You go from being hopefully ahead of your airplane, hopefully at least with your airplane, to being behind your airplane. Okay, all of a sudden you have this panic that sets in with regard to, hey, where the heck am I at night? And in this case here, this guy is dependent upon his goofy little GPS, and it becomes a huge distraction. He's looking at the cigarette holder. He's trying to figure out, hey, why did I lose power with this thing? And all of a sudden his lifeline has abandoned him.
Slipped away.
But, hey, it's a night VFR. Is this a big problem or a little problem? It all depends on how we manage it, doesn't it?
Yes.
This guy mismanaged it to the point where he's now at 600 feet heading for the ground. Thank God he was in Florida, because in a lot of other locations, 600 feet gets you in a very, very dangerous situation.
He needed to recognize also as he took that turn out over that swamp that that is such a dark area. There's just no reference. And that has to turn on a caution light in our minds, I think, as pilots that say, when I'm over this dark area, swamp, water, desolate country, I have to pay more attention to that airplane, not less attention.
We're back to instrument flying the instruments, and you can't really rely on the outside references anymore. Even if you did see anything outside on a clear night with a couple of lights on the ground and a couple of stars.
Which is up, which is down.
Which is up, which is down. Yeah. There's a famous accident off Martha's Vineyard with that.
Let's talk about situational awareness then. I mean, how many pilots routinely, when they hear the word radar vectors, kind of click off, okay, ATC, you got it, and we go into the passenger mode as opposed to the pilot in command mode. What are some of the things this guy could have done on that night to keep himself from getting lost? Once you get lost, it's too late, but we, as the pilot in command, have a lot of resources available to avoid that situation, do we not?
Absolutely. The first thing would have been to just follow your position on some sort of chart, whether you've got a paper chart or a tablet or something. The GPS obviously wasn't helping anymore, but something to maintain the situational awareness and keep track of where you are. Just because we're instrument pilots doesn't mean we can put the sectional away.
You've got to remember there still are a number of airports which have VORs on the field.
Yep.
This can be of assistance. Regardless of where you have the number one VOR tuned, use the number two to orient yourself to the airport if there's a VOR on the field. Use it. Use what's available, and it can help. As we have here, no GPS can help in those situations. Unfortunately, there is no VOR on the field at this airport.
And how many of us, though, just rely on that GPS and the moving map? And this fellow was using it properly until it died on him. But isn't that the case? Doesn't it always die at the point when you need it the most? And if you haven't thought that through and planned on that, you don't have some backup, then you're going to get in trouble, as he did really quick.
And, of course, he did ignore a warning. He'd been flying the whole time with it, flashing low battery.
Good point, yeah.
So there's a reason they put those warnings on the thing.
Something's wrong.
Yeah, something's wrong. And there was a couple of uncomfortable situations that started happening. The first uncomfortable situation was your first night IFR flight. You're out there to get some practice, okay? The second one now is the GPS is flashing this low battery message. The third one is you didn't get the approach that you really wanted. The fourth one is now ATC has kind of turned you away from the airport or where you really want it to be. And it's never one thing. It's always this little sequence of events that leads us into that situation where we're now 600 feet over the Everglades in a spiral.
And it all starts with the word we said here, which is night. And boy, pilots, the world around have to recognize that flying at night is different. We've lost so much visual feedback, and flying is all about visual. And when you give up that visual reference, or you give up an element or a proportion of that visual reference, you know, you're setting yourself up. What does that mean? We're now much more susceptible to vertigo, disorientation. Now, what percentage of pilots are subject to vertigo disorientation?
100.
All of them.
100%. And how long does it take for us to go from a situation of full awareness to vertigo disorientation? Well, it can happen
in seconds.
And especially when you're distracted like this guy is, introduce a little bit of head movement. You got lights out here. You got darkness out here in the swamps. I can list a whole bunch of fatal accidents that occurred in situation just like that. Everything we read about, everything we've studied about vertigo disorientation is misinterpretation of the horizon. And the horizon down in that area with lights all over the place and darkness over here is just the environment that will bring us into vertigo disorientation. You get that sensation that you're tumbling or falling. What do? You're going to flip that airplane right upside down because your body is telling you that you're turning, that you're falling, and it's absolutely wrong sensation based upon the inner ear, which is lying to you.
Getting back to what to do in this situation, I want to circle back to the go-around. The Instrument Procedures Handbook indicates that if you are unable to complete a visual approach, you go around. Now, what does that mean? I think it means you have to decide what to do in this case. There is no prescribed text that says climb to a specific altitude or turn to any specific heading. That's what makes this particularly a problem for this pilot. What does he do next?
Well, he's got to climb. He's got to climb. He's at 600 feet. He didn't intend to be there. He doesn't see anything.
It goes back to the three things that you mentioned. It's the aviate, navigate, communicate. Aviating has got to be the first thing here. Fly the airplane. Get a wings level climb going. Then navigate, figure out where you are, and then communicate.
Wasn't this pilot approaching his individual capacity? You got a new IFR guy. He wants to go out and learn and grow, and that's good. But what were his boundaries? What were his personal minimums? As you said, John, all of a sudden the sequence of events is leading him down the road towards the accident, and he was only a step or two away from being a fatality. What did he really want? He wanted an instrument approach which would have allowed him full situational awareness. He gave that up. His choice. But he made that choice, went down that road. Did he really need that GPS that he was so worried about losing anymore? Was that a key element on a VFR night going into an airport, talking to ATC?
Probably
no.
Not.
But once again, the sequence of events was kind of sucking him in to his individual capacity. And losing 400 feet at night in that situation is pretty darn bad and just kind of shows how badly things were deteriorating for this poor fellow on that night.
Stepping back even further, this was a flight designed to gain some experience. Probably a bad choice of a routing and a place to go for this particular pilot. New guy, tough environment, a lot of activity in that area. Just might have been a little bit over his head at this point.
And as Bob said, the darkness
factor,
he could have changed this whole scenario if he had just chosen to do this during the day. Probably would have turned out a whole lot different.
Right.
And I'll tell you, we talk about communications, fundamental to aviation. Communications were at the forefront of so many of the issues here. Had he clearly communicated to ATC what he wanted, had he clearly communicated with ATC when he started having problems, he would have never gotten as far down the road as he got. And I think it just points out to us, confess early. And also the fundamentals, basic airmanship, fly the airplane. Losing that much altitude at night for an instrument-qualified guy is a bad mistake, but just once again showed how impressive distractions can be and how fatal they can be if unmanaged.
That very swamp he was flying over has claimed more than one airplane and a lot of pilots and passengers. The very well-known Lockheed L-1011 accident out there killed a number of people. Again, simply because they were distracted over a very dark area. All three pilots got distracted, flew the airplane into the swamp.
And that gets into, once again, situational awareness. Do we know the airport we're going into? We know of countless air carriers that have landed at the wrong airport at night just because they weren't paying attention. They're looking for an airport. There's an airport. It looks like a runway, and they land on the runway. Up at Hill Air Force Base out in Utah, they fly right over Hill going into Salt Lake City. The approach brought you right over Hill. There's an airport. There's a runway, and you land. Down there at Tampa, MacDill is right near Tampa, and that's happened a lot. Once again, if we're looking for an airport with a runway light, there's one there waiting for us.
In almost every case, the pilot has accepted a visual approach, or they've said, cancel IFR, I have the airport in sight. If they would have stayed with their full approach, they would have no doubt landed at the proper airport.
It's been going on for a while now, but the FAA has been putting notations either on approach plates or in the AFD. Like Poughkeepsie and Stewart are very similar, opposite sides. And in Poughkeepsie, in the AFD, it says, do not mistake Stewart for Poughkeepsie. There's been so many people landed at the wrong airport that they've actually taken the action to put that information to the pilot.
Once again, situational awareness. Where am I in being ahead of the airplane versus behind the airplane? This guy got behind the airplane, and he needed to communicate that to somebody.
And it happened so quickly. That's what was impressive about this, too, is the entire thing probably took all of 2 minutes, something like that.